Welcome to NanoNewton, podcast discussions with scientists and MIT students in the field of nanomechanics. I'm your host, Christine Ortiz, Associate Professor in the Department of Materials Science and Engineering at MIT, and we're coming to you from Cambridge, Massachusetts. So our guest today is January 19th, 2007, and for the past 2 weeks, we have embarked on an exciting new project involving the recording of podcasts in conjunction with the undergraduate engineering course 3052, Nanomechanics of Materials and Biomaterials. And this is a course that I'll be teaching in the spring term semester, which starts approximately 2 weeks from now. So this introductory podcast is just to explain to you the project and give you some background on the project and how it came about and what it's all about. So we're going to go around the room and introduce all our podcasters. So we're happy to have actually Matt Russell, who is the producer of these podcasts, joining us as a guest as well, in addition to all of our recurring and guest podcasters that have participated in the last 2 weeks. So Matt, can you give us a little of your background and introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Christine. My name is Matt Russell. I work here at MIT in the Audiovisual Services Department. I'm an audiovisual specialist. I do live sound and recordings for a lot of events that happen here on campus. I've been fortunate enough to be doing these podcasts for the past 2 weeks. It's been fun. That's basically it, I guess.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Laura Daher. I'm an undergrad podcaster in the chemistry department, and I've been year-offing with Professor Ortiz.
Hi, I'm Danielle France. I'm a graduate student in biological engineering, hopefully in my final year. And I'm
or final semester, right?
Yeah, definitely final year, hopefully final semester. Yeah. And I'll be TAing for 3052 this semester.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline Green. I'm a senior in materials science and engineering, and I've been year-hopping in Professor Ortiz's lab.
Hi, I'm Benjamin Brouet. I'm a grad student in materials science and engineering, and I work in Christine Ortiz's lab.
Hi, my name is Jay Choi, a graduate student in civil and environmental engineering and doing interdisciplinary study with Christine Ortiz.
Great. Thank you, everybody, for coming today. So I thought we would start today's podcast with Matt, and maybe he can explain to us the definition of what a podcast is and what is kind of the state of podcasting at MIT. And even though it sounds like a basic question, I can't tell you how many people I've run into at MIT over the last few weeks who have seen kind of all the mics in my office and asked, what are you doing? And then I say, I'm doing a podcast. And they're like, what's that? I mean, at least five to ten people have asked me what podcasts are. So Matt, go ahead.
Sure. The basic thing that's going on in the podcasting world is people are making recordings of all different kinds, a lot of conversation. They're recording them to the MP3 format or converting them into MP3s, trying to produce like their own little shows and put them on the internet. Podcasts are unique in that they can be something that you can subscribe to. iTunes allows you to go ahead and subscribe to a whole number of podcasts that are available on the internet. And through RSS, which is a way of distributing knowledge of things that are out there already, it's a way of sort of subscribing on the internet to something, and it'll send you a message saying that there's a new podcast available. You can have it automatically download that podcast, or you can choose to go and get the individual ones that you want. Personally, I'm a big fan of the Onion News, and I subscribe to the the Onion podcast and get a good laugh every day. They produce one every day. And there's people of all different backgrounds and different professions that are doing this. In terms of what's going on here at MIT, I'd say that podcasting is in its infancy stage at this point here. Surprisingly so, there's a lot going on here, and I would expect the number of podcasts to explode on this campus over the next 2 to 3 years. I think it's going to be very popular. But I think MIT is still trying to figure out how they want to manage it. There's a number of people that are trying to get a handle on it. I've been involved with a whole number of meetings that have taken place, but unfortunately there hasn't been a lot of movement yet. But the more podcasts that start getting going on their own and start getting posted, I think people, it's kind of a wait and see, and they'll just see what other people do.
Do you think MIT will want to have some control over the podcasts that are coming out from its campus? Like, we do these all these podcasts, and we post them, and the whole world's going to hear them.
I certainly do think they'll want some control over it, but I think that they will have little to none. It'll be it'll be a matter of whether or not the people who are doing the podcasts want to opt into that. I think it would be a good thing if everybody was working sort of from the same platform, the same place, in terms of being able to search them and organize them. I know libraries is all over this, trying to come up with a way to tag the MP3s so that later down the road they'll be searchable. And I think that's a very good thing, though I think it's going to spin a little out of control for a little while until they get a grasp of how to manage it.
And so the term podcast, do you know if that still has anything to do with iPod, or it's taken its own kind of its own kind of definition on its own?
I think that it's both. I think that I think that people are definitely moving them onto their iPod device and listening to them as they're walking around. But I think
but you certainly don't need an iPod to listen
to it. And largely it a podcast can also be something you didn't subscribe to. People are calling just a show that they produced and turned into an MP3 and stuck it on a server somewhere. They're calling those podcasts, where you know, the subscription thing is what really generates a lot of traffic to it. I think you don't need to do it. You know, certainly word of mouth is obviously pretty powerful on the internet, and a lot of word of mouth about the things that happen here, I'm sure, would carry any of these through with no subscription necessary.
So I have a question. When you when someone goes to the MIT website, right on the front page, there's a link to podcasts. Where does that take you?
I'm not sure what's going on in the back end. I know that libraries is involved. I don't know exactly what server you're going to, or if people are just managing it themselves. I would assume that that is going to one place.
It looks like it's going to IS, which is our information services.
And they definitely provide a service for it, but not too many people are taking advantage of it yet.
There's only
a
few.
People are just publishing it in their own.
It's on this campus, people have a tendency to take matters into their own hands. And just
as
get
you've seen,
as
we've done.
And I think that's what's going on there.
All right. So I guess before we start getting into the project, I thought I'd ask all the podcasters if they listen to or subscribe to any podcasts.
Yeah, I do. I've been listening to the Nature podcast, which is pretty good. I haven't heard it for a while. I don't know if something happened to it. But I've actually gotten ideas for experiments off of some of the papers that people have presented on the Nature podcast.
And so I guess the Nature podcast is more like a news review of kind of each issue. So it's kind of like snippets of each
article. And they usually do sort of what we were doing. They'll often call the author and ask them a few questions and ask them to explain parts of the paper. There's one called Science Friday. And there's one called The Naked Scientist.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
And that's the same guy who does the Nature podcast.
Oh, really?
And then when I took a recent trip to Italy, and one of the things I found is that you could download travel guides onto your via podcasts. And so they would, you know, we went to Venice, and we just put on our headphones and took a ride on the Grand Canal, and it was the podcast was explaining all the places
around.
So there was a lot of quality difference there too. Like National Geographic had some which were really good, the one that we used on the Grand Canal in Venice, but there are also some that was just some guy reading like his 25 favorite foods in Italy.
That's funny.
But yeah, I thought that was a really nice aspect to a twist on the travel guide. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's cool. Anyone else?
I guess I've downloaded a couple of NPR podcasts at times, just like different news issues that are particularly interesting. Sometimes they'll do like a special edition podcast, a series of different things on one event. So they're useful because you can listen to them on your way to class, so you don't need to sit down, and you can catch up on news as you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess I started listening to them just because my drive to work is about 40 minutes. So I have a little connector, you know, to connect my iPod in the car, and then I can, you know, listen to science and things and not waste, because I hate driving so much because it's a waste of time, right?
Right. That's the genius thing about podcasting is anyone can talk about any subject they want to. And whether you're, you know, it doesn't matter what it is, and you can choose to listen to that broadcast anytime, anywhere you want, whether it be driving to work or, you know, while you're working out or, you know, anything. It's really great to be able to listen to things that you're interested in, very specific things that you're interested in, and by knowledgeable people totally at your leisure, whenever you want. It's great.
Yeah, and you can get them on so many different subjects. You know, I'm interested in lots of different things. I listen to NASA podcasts and I listen to scientific conferences that have been downloaded on MP3. You can get podcasts of all the world leaders, you know, Nelson Mandela, Bill Clinton, et cetera. Listen to those, you know. But I think, and I'll go through what we've been doing. I think what we've done is a little bit unique in terms of podcasting, in particular in science. So, okay. Any other? So maybe you guys will start listening to podcasts now after you participated in this project, right?
I've listened to a couple, but not like regularly. For classes, actually. Actually, one thing I remember was it was an interview with one of the first – he was a boy of 12 at the time when he actually received a lobotomy, and he never discussed it with his parents afterwards. And so it was his interview with this boy and, you know, and his trying to find out what had happened and all that. So that was really an interesting interview. Like, I was fascinated. But, I have to check out some of these websites.
They're really great. And I think that going back to what Matt said, not only can you listen to anything, but it, when you publish one, it can go literally, you know, around the world. It's so far-reaching, you know, that anyone that has a computer, you know, access to the Internet can download it and you really don't realize how far, you know, your message can be sent. I hope ours will go very far.
This podcast is at least going to Australia because it'll be on my family mailing list.
Okay.
So all my relatives had better read it.
That's great. Okay, so I'm going to describe a little bit about our project. So all of our NanoNewton podcasts were recorded during what's called our independent activities period in the last 2 weeks, which is January 2007. And this is a period when MIT students do not have any required classes, and hence I have no teaching as well, which is why I could actually devote some time to this. And when I started it, I actually didn't realize how much time it would constitute, and I've been kind of living this the last 2 weeks. I kind of just jumped into it and said, oh, this is such a cool idea, let's do it, and then all of a sudden 2 weeks is completely gone of doing this. But it was so worthwhile. I think that what the goal of this is to really use the podcast as an educational tool. And so it's integrated into this class that I'm teaching in the spring. So during the semester, the students are going to be asked to listen to one podcast almost every week. And the podcast that we're doing highlights a recent paper in the literature that's related to the that week's lecture material. And so all of our podcasters here basically have an informal discussion with the MIT students and one or more of the authors of this highlighted paper. And many of them will call in from around the world, or many of them were here at MIT, and so they could join us here. And the podcasts are being run from my office, which is in Building 13 at MIT. So the recurring podcasters, which you've met today, represent both graduate and undergraduate students from a variety of different departments: material science and engineering, biological engineering, chemistry, civil engineering. And the podcast really represents a conduit for which the most recent and exciting research can be infused into the course. And so all the papers that we chose were published within the last year. And it provides this really exciting kind of opportunity for the students to have the papers explained to them directly from the authors from all around the world. And not only that, but the authors will then also describe experiments that have gone on since the paper was published. And some of them have even went on to describe experiments that they did the exact day of the podcast. So I think that podcasting is just starting to be an educational tool. At MIT, I've heard some podcasts where the professors will explain problem sets or record a lecture. as a supplementary kind of thing for students to aid in their educational process. And so what we've done is really kind of taken a different approach in using this kind of discussion format, which is quite different. And our hope is that the project will really be kind of a testbed model for the use of the technology for teaching at our institute and hopefully beyond. So we hope that it will go much farther than that. So I guess one of our podcasters, Ben Brewitt, will explain the format of each podcast and how we set it up.
So, the format of the podcast is going to be fairly similar from one podcast to another. Basically, one podcast will revolve around a specific paper, the scientific paper of the day. It will start with a short bio of the guest of the day, and then the scientific guest will introduce the other authors and their contribution to the paper. Then the core of the podcast will involve a description of the experimental methods. There will be comments on the data, the difficulties, the major difficulties that the authors encountered in the paper, and of course all the podcasters will be able to pitch in and ask questions. And finally, toward the end of the podcast, the guests will be asked where they are now in terms of research, what type of current research they're conducting. At the beginning also there will be an explanation of the basic terms that are important to understand to be able to follow the discussion. And some of the junior level undergraduates that are taking the course here at MIT, the nanomechanics course, in many cases they will be able to understand those terms already, because they will be familiarized with those terms during the class. But the purpose is also to allow younger students, freshmen, and even high school students who may be listening to the podcast, who also understand some basic concepts, scientific concepts. So the majority of the podcast is aimed at the undergraduate level, as we've said, but by the end, typically, it will reach up to the graduate level. And generally speaking, those podcasts, they're meant to be an educational tool that will supplement traditional materials that will be seen in class lecture, but not replacing them. It's just more like an informal discussion with the students. It's not going to have an intense high-level scientific. It's not going to have an intense high-level scientific debate, for example, on the data interpretation, so that, as I said, younger students can follow the discussion. And, that's pretty much it.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Ben. As you'll see during the podcast, as a host, I try to ask kind of clarifying questions, basic questions throughout the podcast that will enable the participants to explain fundamental concepts, nanomechanics concepts that are embedded in the class. And then eventually the students will be assigned both quantitative and qualitative homework problems about the podcast in their problem sets throughout the semester. Okay, so I think we can move on to talk about I feel that the podcasting project was so successful, and I've talked to Matt about this a little, that we'll probably continue with a secondary project this summer. And so Matt had some suggestions, I guess, for how to do that. I guess one idea we were thinking about is really extending this to high-level scientific debates, where we could choose a paper and have three or four scientists from around the world who are top experts in the field really have it out. And,
Nano fights.
Nano fights. I think that would be a lot of fun. And Matt had an idea about having a – maybe – and this was something I was going to ask you in the beginning. beginning about how what's the difference between a podcast and a live show on the internet. So maybe you can explain that.
Yeah, sure. You could actually take those live to the internet, so it wouldn't be something that it would be something that would be available later as a podcast and downloadable. But you could actually take it live out on the internet and use some of our some companies that are related to MIT in one form or another, and actually push a live stream out on the internet so that you could take live calls. You mm-hmm. could sort of like, you know, maybe great. Even have like surprise guests, you know, and really run it like a show and make it, you know, to start, I would say they should be, you know, 30 minutes and just get your feet wet with it. Take a break in the middle, you know, maybe run some ads.
Get some supporters to pay for the advertisement.
Or at least things that are going on at MIT that might be related and pre-can those ads into real, you know, real commercials that you could produce here. And then eventually expand those and make them hour-long programs, you know, with the goal of maybe once a week having a live show and then mm-hmm. a series of podcasts that aren't meant to be live shows, that are just what you guys have been doing here, and then make those live shows again available for download later.
Yeah, it's amazing that we can actually do that and that, you know, that's accessible now to everybody.
Certainly.
As opposed to, you know, thinking about making a live radio show, how much that would have taken
the license to get a frequency, let alone, I mean, even if we were to go to the MIT radio station and try to pull something like that off, it's very complicated. And then you're also, you know, you've sort of lost that sense of control that you had when you were doing your own show. Now you're sort of at the mercy of other people's desires as to what they'd like the show to be, where with a podcast, it's whatever you want it to be.
That's what I love about it. Total freedom to do whatever we want. Yeah, that's great. So what was I going to say about I was going to say something about the live show. Yeah, so, I mean, I was just thinking, you know, it would be such a great way to address, say, there's some controversial topic in science, right? You know, some huge debate that's going on between two or three people. Well, put them on the podcast, you know, and let them tell their views. And, and you know, I'm sure that lots of people would be listening to it. So, yeah, I mean, I would love to do it, and I hope we can do it this summer. And so do people do these weekly live shows on the internet?
Well, I don't see too many live shows being done just because the resources that are involved would require someone who's really dedicated to the subject. And education has a way of prying open doors that you know, private sector stuff oftentimes just does not. They look at dollar signs. In this case, it's looking at learning, and people just treat it in a totally different light. It's why I work here. It's a much more comfortable environment to work in. And I think that the MIT name, let alone all the things that go on here, you know, you say MIT to anyone, and they know what MIT is and what it represents. And its place in the world, and it can really open some doors. It's something that that I oftentimes feel like it's not taking advantage. I guess that's the wrong line to use, but we should take advantage of it. We should use the name and use who we are, where we're from, as a way of opening doors to extend education outside of MIT. And that's a lot of what I think this podcast is going to do. It's going to open open people up to these things that don't have access otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, and we could go back to, say, OpenCourseWare, which has tried to kind of, you know, make access our education or parts of it to the world.
It's a great concept. And,
you know, and I think this could be even, you know, greater because it's so attractive to young people and so many people in the podcast format. And you could think of combining both of them.
Certainly.
Does OpenCourseWare have any kind of links to podcasts or anything like that?
The meetings that I've attended, I've never heard any of them talk about it. So I'm not getting that feeling, but I haven't gone out and sought it out myself, so I'm not really sure.
They have video lectures, though, I think, for basic courses like 801
Certainly.
And chemistry and stuff.
So, yeah.
Yeah. But those are just the lectures, not really discussions. But I think those are actually really popular. Like, I worked in France over the summer, and my professor knew the MIT, you know, open course website, and he actually, like, reviewed basic physics just because it was there, you know. So
wow. So OpenCourseWare, you think, is being really used around the world?
I think, you know, for some people, it's definitely a great resource.
Hmm.
Yeah. It's pretty wildly popular.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you can get, and especially, he liked that you could see, like, really famous professors and hear their lectures just as if you were a MIT student.
Huh.
So I think, like, this would be a great, like, you know, thing to go along with that.
Yeah.
Mm, certainly.
That's great. So, Matt, you mentioned that we don't have a studio on campus now. Is that the case?
Yeah.
I mean, you had commented on it would be great to have a studio, but I actually kind of like having it in my office, you know?
I do, too, until a truck backs up outside.
Yeah, I know. Okay, there's a lot of noise outside and everything. But it's more informal. You know, I think that, you know, when we usually start the podcast, a lot of the participants are very aware of the microphone and very kind of reserved. And, you know, a few minutes into it, they completely forget they're on a podcast because we're just having a discussion.
Well, I feel like if you built the studio properly, you could certainly achieve that.
Couches and stuff.
I would certainly not. Yeah. I don't want it to be like evening news, you know. You don't have to wear a suit to the podcast, you know. I'd want it to be comfortable and make it an environment that people can open up the way they do here and laugh and enjoy themselves so that people tend to be more candid when they do that. And that's what you're looking for here is candor. You want people to sort of open up and really, you know, dig into a question and get a real answer and almost demand a real answer, you know, where in network news they oftentimes blow off the real answer.
I think that's a major difference. It's a major difference. The podcasts are, you know, when you're in a conference or something, a lot of times it's a scripted answer.
Mm-hmm.
And a podcast is very informal where you're getting a real, you know, getting down to the real informal answer. Did you guys find that?
I've learned a lot just, you know, on a subject I really didn't know that much about, like the lubrication one. And I read the paper and I was like, okay, I kind of know what he's talking about. But after the podcast, I was like, oh.
Yeah, then you learn so much.
It's much, much clearer. So,
There's so many times, you know, you read papers and you have all these questions because, you know, something's not clear or the figures. And you see even some of the authors said, oh, the reviewers didn't even understand what this figure was saying. Or why is there that big black bar in the middle of the plot when that's actually the data, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess one of you had asked, I don't know who asked about the big bar in one of the podcasts. I think, Ben, maybe you did. And he's like, yeah. Reviewers, like, can you remove that, please? There's something there on it. And
actually,
so, yeah, you learn so much.
I remember I thought the lubrication paper was a particularly good example because it was obvious that since it was in a Nature letter, that they had to really condense the paper.
Yeah.
Like, there was no introduction whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so when we actually got, I thought that the paper was very dense and you could get the general idea, but you couldn't really get into the intricacies. And when we got to actually talk to him and he could give the background and the introduction and he gave us a lot of the historical background too of the instrument, that really helped in understanding what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, in that one there was like four sets of control experiments that were condensed in addition to the data and the initial control, there was four additional ones. Mm-hmm. It was so dense, yeah. And so when we finally got to that was great.
And I think another advantage of the podcast is I want to talk about the brain system of our body because, in my case, the lipid paper that I involved, I already read everything. I understood almost everything. But when I talked to the original author, then I came to know it's becoming more clear because I'm listening. You know, our system, our body system is not just the reading. If we listen something, it observes more and then making everything clear and have more like a network idea of, this part is connected to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the main reason why when you're talking something and listening something and then get more idea. And then, you know, our brain has some like brainstorming and then get some more creative idea. I think this is one of the good advantages of the podcast.
Yeah. I mean, I found that when I interview and I sit through the podcast and then I go back and I listen again, I hear things that I didn't really hear the first time.
Right.
And, you know, it's almost like I get double when I'm listening to it
exactly.
The second time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, did they say that? I didn't really hear that. I guess I'm always thinking about the next question or what I'm going to ask. And so a lot of times I'll miss some things. Yeah. And I guess the other thing that it's kind of provided, at least for me, an opportunity is you know, it's just been such a joy having scientific discussions for an hour or 2 hours. It's like, you know, we're at MIT and you never stop to really do that a lot. Well, a lot of times, you know, because everybody's so busy and they have full schedules and booked up. And I think just forcing us all to sit down and really just, you know, have a really nice conversation for an hour or two about some one of the papers was just, you know, very beneficial.
And I think also that beyond the scientific interest for the students, it's also show them that scientists are eager to, you know, speak about their research.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
can do it for hours.
Yeah. And, you know,
they'll comment about their life. That gives also the students a good impression what the life of a scientist can be, you know, at work, at what do they do in the lab, like the difficulty they encounter.
Exactly, and like the conferences and stuff that go on campus are sometimes they're visiting by the most amazing, brilliant people in the world that write these incredible research papers and they're famous in their field and everything. But when they're standing on a stage in a large auditorium, you have no idea what their personality is like. They've got 60 minutes to talk. They deliver their 60 minutes. They go over a little, but you get no sense of who this person is. You really can't read them at all. And when you bring them into this environment and people start laughing, it's incredible how they just open up. And then they'll go, oh, one more story I want to tell you.
Yeah, yeah. I love this. The anecdotes they would come up. Almost every podcaster was like, oh, I have a really funny anecdote of what happened during this time.
Yeah. Or the lubrication professor, you kept explaining things in terms of, like, I don't know, like the scotch tape, like, pulling off. Like, you had all those things, and it really, you know, made things clear.
Yeah, a lot of analogies. Yeah. Any other comments on that?
Oh, when I was being in the podcast, I had another, it came to my mind. If we can make, like, a movie file.
Like a video. Have video podcasts.
Yeah, I'm saying is more like, because they're out of country. So what I'm thinking is everyone, like as you said, two or three famous professors are discussing. Then if they can show some pictures, and then it doesn't have to be showing their face because it's just a waste of the file, you know, size.
Right.
We can just show the one or two pictures of their, you know, main concept. Mm. Then it'd be really helpful. And then, you know, iPod or any MP3. Some player these days they're showing some video file together.
Yeah.
So I think that's another.
So I guess how we were going to try to do that was, you know, in some of them, you know, I had suggested they could have a PowerPoint file and the students could just click on it while they're listening to the podcast. I've been a little bit hesitant to try and think about video podcasts just because the quality has always looked so bad on the internet.
Yeah, it's something that you know? In our department we're actively working on this week. We're actually. Got some new boxes, some new toys, and we're going to take them to a space and start playing around with things. We were actually looking at devices today and trying to figure out how we could get some demos of some boxes from different manufacturers because we haven't really played with it either for that very reason, that we think the quality hasn't really matched what people will expect to see. You know, there's a certain expectation that it's going to be TV quality, even in a small window. Well, the biggest challenge we've always found with doing, even making it small, even if the quality's great, is that these images that scientists want to show require them be fairly large, and there's a great degree of detail, and you have to be able to show that detail. And the new QuickTime 7 makes a huge leap in the right direction for us. The H.264 codec looks great. It's small. It's the new HD DVD standard. It's fantastic. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff that has to happen in front of getting it into that codec that has to all be on this ridiculous broadcast level, and it's very expensive. And
I mean, the thing is, when I like download, say, like movie files from like CNN or Fox, even those look pretty bad. So that's why I've been
They're also aimed
not
at
to insult them.
No, to defend them, they're aiming themselves at a bandwidth market. So as people have moved up from 56K, now the DSL/ you know, cable modem crowd is the most popular sort of way to connect to the internet at home. So they need to tailor the file sizes and streaming capabilities of those people to the size and quality of their video. So I would hope that we would stretch the boundaries at least a little and offer both, you know, offer something that's fairly low, maybe DSL speed, and then also offer something that, you know, a high speed.
Yeah, I guess Yeah, I had also thought about the video podcast, but I didn't think there was too much to see. We're all just sitting here, and they'll see our photos.
Yeah, and that's not our job. That's not our objective either. What we're trying to do is what we want to be able to do is move desktop images, whether they be PowerPoint or Keynote or whatever it is, or PDFs, and be able to move what's on someone's desktop live with audio, so that. We think the slides with audio thing is very, very powerful and a very big deal.
Yeah.
Right.
And we're going to try to get it.
Yeah. I guess what I was really shocked, what really made me want to do it, well, there's a lot of reasons why I want to do it, but I think I was really shocked at the quality of the sound in the podcast. Like, you know, I've been in lots of teleconferences and, you know, you can barely hear them lots of times, but when you listen to this, it just sounds so clear.
You thank you very much.
You know, it literally sounds like you're not, you know, the people calling in are really very close and clear. And so, if it wasn't like that, it would be very difficult, I think, to go through. And all of your guys' voices sound really clear as well. All right. So I guess another topic I'd thought about is actually, so Danielle had mentioned about how the Nature podcast, and I think Science has a podcast too, where they kind of summarize each issue. And sometimes they'll have some additional podcast with like, special podcast or something. And so another interesting idea I'd thought of is actually I have my own webpage with all of our publications and links, and thinking about, well, would it be interesting to have a podcast for each paper that you have right next to the PDF? And so in the future, maybe every journal might want to have a couple of links to podcasts on that particular paper. And, you know, I'm wondering if that's kind of the direction that we're going.
I have one more good idea.
Yeah.
On the paper, if we can click one graph, and if there's an explanation for that, we can connect a link for the one picture and each graph, you know, then people will be very excited to listen to things.
Right? Yeah, I think if you have like two or three podcasts, it's almost the same thing as TV shows. Every TV show has... five, if it's a good show, they'll have 5 or 10 podcasts. And, you know, if it's a good paper, you could have 5 podcasts and get a different opinion on each, you know, on each one. I think, yeah, but I think that, well, then anyone can say anything about a paper, right? So I think it would be much more prone to kind of criticisms, and, right?
Yeah.
And much more painful for authors to be listening to all these people online discussing.
To a certain degree, they have to know that those conversations are happening at universities around the world, that a paper gets published and you know there's somebody in some office somewhere going, there's no way that is true, you know, like, because I've seen it with my own two eyes. And so, but yes, to I guess to...
But it would be public, you know, really percolating throughout,
But it comes back to that old adage of, you know, there's no bad press. It's still people are talking about the paper, and there's, I think, as many people that would jump up, at least at this level of research papers, and many people that would jump up and say that this is not correct. There'd be a whole number of people that would jump up and say it is.
Mm.
And boy, you're right. It would be surely interesting to put that on a web page where you can hear opposing views.
Yeah.
I also feel that there's some sort of it's a lot easier to write an angry email than it is to make an inflammatory podcast, I think.
You're
really?
Not kidding. Yeah, because you've got to be able to defend yourself. You've got to be able to say why you think it's wrong. Yeah. And an email is a one send and goodbye.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do have this mechanism for criticizing papers, which I've seen a lot of cases where you could write like an editorial paper about another paper and comment and say, well, these are all my points, and I think they were incorrect here, incorrect there. But I think that happens rather infrequently, because then you get into a real war, you know, with the other authors. But and so it may be that the podcast may hold it back a little because of that nature, because that hasn't really kind of taken off. But no, we'll see. Yeah, I think it would be a lot more painful for the authors, but overall I think it would push science further a lot faster.
I think you should do it.
We'll see.
When it's voluntary and you can you know, you can show the merits of your own paper, I think it's probably all good.
Yeah. I think, though, it'd be tricky to do like a podcast from your own group on your own papers, because then it's not like... Yeah. It's not objective, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you can explain it and everything.
Have you thought about doing message boards associated with the podcast?
I was thinking of that. And, you know, it does – when I first started doing the podcast, it does take a bit of courage because you really kind of put yourself out there for the whole world to see. And, you know, I guess if you put message boards, then people can put all – I guess you control what's going in. But I don't want to, like, not take all the nasty messages. There's always going to be good and bad messages, mm-hmm. you know. So I have thought about that. I may do that on this site and see what happens. Yeah. What's your opinion on that, Matt?
I think they're incredibly powerful.
The message boards?
I am a member of two different audio engineering ones, and I probably post as many as, I don't know, 60 messages or 100 messages a year. It's every couple of days, basically. I read constantly. It's how I spend a lot of downtime, you know, going through those things. But I learn a tremendous amount from them, and I could see how if you were an audience member of a podcast and you're sitting there listening to it in your car and you've got this idea, rather than send an email off into outer space where you don't even know if you're going to get an answer or a response at all, you could post a message saying, hey, did anybody think to maybe ask that? Next time you talk to that person, ask them this, or you know, or invite that person to join the message boards later to answer additional questions. There's a whole number of things you could do with it.
Yeah. It does take a little bit of a bravery because you open yourself up to the world, you know, giving their opinion on your work and, you know.
But scientists are very brave, so.
Yeah. Most are.
That's funny. So I guess another thing is I was going to ask you, do you think that podcasts could be part of the scientific review process? Like, do you think that in the future people could – send in with their paper a podcast or actually use a podcast to answer reviewers' comments?
Well, I mean, when it already goes on, right? When I guess not from reviewer to author, but from author to editor. Mm-hmm. People will talk on the phone to the editors, and especially, I mean, again, on the lubrication paper, when he was mentioning the roles of the authors, he said his main job was arguing with the Nature editor to get the paper into the journal. And from what I've heard from people who have put papers into Nature and Science, that is a big part of it, is proving not just that your science is good, but persuading them that it's the right time and the right place to put it. And so
it's worthy enough,
So I think if you could attach a podcast with your paper, it sort of would be like a cover letter.
Help sell it. That's
right. And it's much more persuasive than just the paper. And, you know.
Or maybe this is for all of us who are going to be job searching soon.
Resume podcast. Hi, my name is. I'm very good at this and this and this.
Brush up on your audio editing skills. So you're gonna
I heard recently many guys are like Stanford or the Yale students, especially law school students, trying to explain themselves by movie file.
That kind of blew up in the face of one of the
That's right.
He made a resume like that was 12 pages or something like that, and he had this video of himself saying he was, you know, some sort of superhero guy.
But it was not true.
It was not true. And his job, the people who received the video sent it to all their other friends. I don't know if you've heard about this.
I haven't, but
it was kind of sad.
Sounds
and
great.
Then it got onto the internet and they posted it, and then everybody was, that was a bad example. But,
But I think it's very good, actually, if we think about the other way, because when people are talking about something, they have a responsibility of their, you know, saying, because just writing something on the without any name on the website, they're saying very aggressively. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking something and sound, it's everyone knows the face or the sounds, and it is very responsible things, right? Mm. So they should say something very gently or the clearly, not aggressively, you know. So maybe that's another way, the big advantage of a podcast.
Yeah. So do you think new applicants coming into MIT, into undergraduate or graduate school, will be required to include a podcast to their application so that the admissions committees can listen to them?
Oh, that would be cool.
I think it would be cool, but I think you have to be careful how much you feed the frenzy of college applications.
That's true.
I think a lot of
it's
out of hand already.
Then they'll start having training people for podcasts.
Mm-hmm. And the other one is for international international student is
yeah,
that
easy.
Yeah,
that's true.
Right. It would be easier for people who can't get an interview because they live far away to be able to have some sort of contact that's a little bit more personal.
Yeah, yeah. But going back to Danielle's comments on actually hearing, you know, and fighting with the reviewers, and you know, I'd sat in, on a number of panels, and we had site visits or reverse site visits where we would review proposals, and then the teams would come and explain it. And, you know, everybody would have their opinion by reading the proposals, and almost all the, always it would change after you had heard the actual team defending their proposals or explaining it. And so I think that that kind of came through a lot in what we were doing as well.
Right.
Okay. So I guess one last or almost last question to the podcasters. What did you find most surprising or interesting about the project? So maybe we can go around.
I thought one of the things that was the most interesting was that the you know, there is actually a person there, you know, answering, you know, speaking in, you know, basic English and explaining these like complex things. You know, when you read the paper, sometimes it can almost seem like, you know, where did that come from? But to have a voice connected with it, it makes it a lot more interesting. Yeah.
I was really surprised that how eager researchers were to bring in, you know, very fresh data that into their papers. Or and yesterday you even asked, well, you know, is this something that, you know, can we air this because have you published this yet?
Yeah.
So I think that that's really cool that researchers are kind of willing to throw in things. It's almost like a group meeting. It's not like a conference where you have to be able to defend everything thing you say.
It's funny because I totally agree with you, and I'm wondering if the guest participants actually realized what they were saying, because I don't know if they realize how far this is going to go. And once we start talking, you know, oh, I'm so excited about this and this. And, you know, yesterday's podcast with Subrin and John, you know, they described all of these experiments way beyond what was in the paper, and so I was like, whoa, you know. So that's why I asked them, and they said it was submitted, which is, yeah, I think all of them were willing, completely willing to talk about things that weren't even published yet. I found them very open in general, and almost every single person I asked to do it was willing to. They were actually so excited about doing it, and I think that connecting with the students, you know, from across oceans, or, you know, was just a big draw for them. No one really said, oh, I'm too busy, can't do it. And think about the time, you know, that an hour to 2 hours, plus the preparation, everything that they were willing to devote to these. And these are, you know, top scientists from around the world who are, you know, an hour is like precious, precious to them.
I thought it was interesting how much better the conversation was than a paper discussion class without one of the authors.
Mm.
So you can get a room full of people with some professors in the same area and you know, a lot of intelligent people discussing the paper, and it's still not going to get as deep or as interesting as when the author is actually there.
I'm surprised at how quiet they are, too. The audience members and a lot of those things, I've done sound for them, and I sit there and there's a person presenting and no one says a word while that person's presenting. They might ask a couple of questions or a large number of questions at the end, but there's no discussion, and it's meant to be a discussion. Hmm. It's billed as a discussion, and it's not really a discussion. It's some guy standing up there and showing his PowerPoint and yapping away, and then the next guy goes up, and it just continues to happen. This was far more conversational, and which is, I guess, why they were willing
Maybe it was because we never gave them a chance to talk first. We just started asking questions.
Yeah.
Actually, I think that's the disadvantage of a seminar, because, you know, we need to talk and ask to the, you know, presenter, but it's not easy, right? It's time problem.
Yeah.
But this one is, I think, how powerful it is. I mean, everyone is listening from the main author and then some talking, and then they just get to know, I mean, listener will get to know this paper very quickly, and then this actually will go to the next step technology very fast. You know, this will be really powerful to, you know, increase the, some speed of the developing technology in the future.
I think the authors really appreciate when you're not just discussing like the data, but you ask them, well, what did it take to get you this data? How long did the experiments take? You know, what did you have to go through to actually face to be able to get this data?
It's far more personal.
And you really get a feeling for the understanding of, you know, all the steps they went through and their struggles, their pain, you know, all the way up. Any comments on
Yeah, no, definitely. To me, the most interesting was the human interaction between, you know, the scientists, and also when they reflect on their own life, you know, when you ask them more personal questions.
About right, like how they gotten interested.
Exactly, maybe their PhD studies and where or where they see themselves in a couple of years. And
how it all breaks down is pretty incredible, like in this format, how all that stuff, all the formality gets sort of taken out of it, and you get to see a human being who did this work.
And I think that for me, I mean, I found the history of a lot of these papers fascinating. You know, I never had heard the stories. Even I've worked with Alan, you know, Grzynski for 6 to 7 years, and I hadn't heard really about, you know, how he got into – I mean, I'd heard bits and pieces, but, you know, to have him tell the whole story. And Jakob Klein, same thing about when he was a postdoc and when he first, you know, built the SFA, the Weizmann, I think it was – quite exciting.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so I think we're about finished with the introduction. I don't know how long we it was longer than I thought it would be. But I guess I will just say thank yous to everybody who was involved in the project. I'll go through all my thank yous. So I wanted to thank Laura first, because she was the one who attended every single podcast. And I want to thank Danielle, because she's very busy with her thesis and also made the efforts to come when she didn't have to. Thank you. And of course, Matt, the excellent producer who came every time. And everybody else who participated. And of course, I really want to thank all the authors who called in and spent all their times. And I think everybody wants to really express their gratitude and appreciation for spending the time with us, and that the students will really benefit so much from them actually participating. We hope that you will listen to all the podcasts, those of you who aren't in the nanomechanics class, mm-hmm. I hope. And thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.